Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
All right, let's welcome back to the show, Ian Cron. Ian, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, how's your time been in Malibu?
It's hard not to have a nice time in Malibu.
Yeah.
It's been great. I mean, I've taken pictures of the Pepperdine campus and texted them back to my children and asked them why they hadn't maybe thought about this as a potential site for their continuing education. So I could come visit them here.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
You know what's great about Malibu is that I go to Chipotle probably four times a week, and not only did I make you eat Chipotle tonight, but my first meal in Malibu, I went to Chipotle and got it and then ate it right there.
You've now outed me as somebody who ate Chipotle for dinner tonight. That's terrible.
What? What is wrong with Chipotle?
I don't know. It's great.
Chipotle is going to be the official sponsor of this podcast one day.
That's a professional goal?
That's a goal. I have very lofty goals for this podcast.
Man, you just keep on track, man.
Well, you know, they say, shoot for the stars and you land on the moon.
That's right.
You know, maybe I won't get Chipotle, but I'll get what? Hardee's?
Something like that.
Yeah, Freebirds. Well, okay, so what we want to talk about today. I heard you make this line earlier in a class where you started going on a tangent, but you stopped yourself when you said you have disdain for the word relevant and authentic. You didn't want to go on a rant during your class, but you know what? I think it's a great time for you to go on that rant. Mm. Now, here's the thing. People know you as a writer. They know you as a speaker. Hopefully, people realize, though, before that, you were a pastor. Mm-hmm. And so you're someone who's put the sweat equity into church. You're not one of these people who can bash the church without having actually put the blood, sweat, and tears into building and serving and being part of a church. Mm-hmm. You served how many years were you?
10 years, senior pastor of a church.
Yeah, and it was a church you started, right? Mm-hmm. So you have credibility when you speak to the church. And obviously, as a church planner, you started the church. You were there 10 years, church you planted. Now, many of your fellow church planners use this language of authentic and relevant, but you don't like it. And so as someone who has put the years in, who has the credibility, what makes you hate that so much?
Well, I mean, the word relevant, as I understand it, and I think I'm right on this, if you were to break it down in Latin, it just means rewashed.
What?
Yeah. No. It means to wash over again. So it's like taking an article of clothing and running it through the wash twice. Okay. Relevant. Again, like even in Spanish, right? Levantar, to wash. So to rewash something.
So what you're saying is we're going to make church to be appear to be worthy and clean and...
Well, it's just like redoing, but it's the same. I keep thinking to myself, so what you're saying is you want to take the same garment and just wash it.
Yeah.
And make it into something else. I'll just say that, without getting too deep down into the sort of the language of this thing, to me it doesn't smell of anything that's what they're describing is we want to do something really cutting edge and innovative and, you know, et cetera. And they keep using the word relevant, and I keep thinking to myself, well, that usually means one of two things to me. Accommodationism, I want to accommodate, you know, a group of people and their tastes and their interests and maybe, you know, put the gospel somewhere in the mix, you know.
Yeah.
In that. Or it's I just want to take the same old thing and just dress it up a different way and call it relevant, you know.
Yeah.
So to me, it just sort of smacks of, you know, salesmanship and promotion and branding and all these other words that I really find myself recoiling from.
Wait, you don't like the word branding?
I don't.
Why not?
Well, I think it's actually, as a writer, when I hear things like brand and platform and content, I think that's all like it smacks of literary genocide to me. The language of genocide.
Okay, that's kind of harsh language.
I know, but, you know, the first thing you do when you have an enemy that you're en route to a cleansing of some kind of thing is you stop using language for them that's human. You start to refer to
them as
turkeys, or they're less than human, you know.
Yeah.
It's a turkey shoot, or, you know, you start to change the language to diminish their humanity so that it makes it easier to kill them. All right.
Okay.
Well. All right. So if you, how do you think Hemingway would feel if you said, called A Farewell to Arms content? Or what would he say if you said, Mr. Hemingway, or, you know, whoever, tell us about your platform? I think he'd say, that's, you mean my readership?
You
that's
think
different. Or if you were to say to him, you know, what's your, you know, your brand, he wouldn't understand it. It'd be crass. It would be to trivialize it. His brand is his voice.
Mm-hmm.
He has a particular voice, and that voice is sacred. Whether it's his voice or Annie Dillard's voice or, you know, the long list of great literary voices, Faulkner, Robbins, somebody go on and on, right?
Mm-hmm.
These people have voices, not brands. They have great literary works, not content. They have a readership that is intelligent and thoughtful. They are not a platform.
Yes.
I, you know what I'm saying? So when you start to change the language like that, and you're moving an art form into something that is a slave of market language, and I just find that really makes me very ill at ease.
Yes. Okay. So you don't like that because of how it turns.
I think it's demeaning.
Demeaning to who's it more demeaning to, the writer or the reader?
It should be to both.
You gotta give me one. I mean, is,
well, if a reader wants to be called a platform, that's fine with me. That's their business. But I consider them a readership, an intelligent community of people that are reading your hard work. And
so, as a fancy pants New York Times bestseller, you don't want to say the
people. Well, I'm not a New York Times bestseller. Actually, I'm a Wall Street Journal bestseller, but I'm not a New York Times bestseller.
What's the difference?
Well, this is two different newspapers.
Well, I know that. I mean, what
well, yeah, okay. It's a best-selling author, right?
Okay. Well, whoever. And you're Luke Norris with the best-selling author. I like reading your book. So as someone who is a reader of yours, I don't want to be considered a platform because it demeans me into just someone who's going to buy your goods.
Yeah, I just don't think the word consumer is a compliment.
Yeah.
You know, I think of you as someone who is an intelligent, thoughtful person who's interested in engaging with ideas and coming alongside a thinker or a writer and wanting to take from them. This is a very important social and in some ways spiritual transaction that's happening between two people.
Mm-hmm.
A reader and a writer,
mm-hmm.
and to kind of throw it on the pile of brand content platform, it just sounds smacks of kind of, I don't know, car salesman language.
Yeah.
And I think that diminishes, that's why I use the word, you know, it's sort of like the language of literary genocide. We're now using other words for things that were at one time very beautiful ideas, and now we've turned them into market language, and that's always a little scary.
Yeah, yeah.
And to your point now, just circling back about relevant and authentic, all I was going to say was, relevant to me just rings of desperation. You know, we got to be relevant. You know, it's got to be innovative. It's got to be cutting edge. Otherwise, it is going to not succeed in the market, in the religious marketplace among our consumer base.
Well,
I just find that troubling, you know, like,
yeah.
and the idea of it being relevant, you know, it's just the moment you start trying to do these things, it becomes
across
a cartoon of itself.
And so the language of, as a pastor, I'm saying, I'm going to make this relevant. That means currently what it is right now does not connect with people. And so somehow this is stale, this is outdated, or to use the Latin etymology, which you brought up before, it is a sullied product that no one wants to put on, right? Isn't that kind of the, if you're not making it relevant, what it is before, it's not good enough.
Into human lives in a way that illuminates parts of their persons and their experience, casts a light on things that helps them to make sense of who they are and the possibility of who God is in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Often though, when you start to talk about relevance in the church, to me, it usually means, how do I get more people in here?
Yeah.
It sounds like, okay, what's the hook?
Okay, so at your church, it was in Greenwich. Is that
Greenwich,
right?
Yeah, Greenwich, Connecticut.
Greenwich. Mm-hmm. So it's not Greenwich, it's Greenwich.
It's spelled like Greenwich, but it's like.
Okay, so I've read it. Maybe that's why it came up.
The British spelling is Greenwich, yeah.
Oh, excuse me. For all of our British.
No, like audience. Greenwich, England, the Greenwich Mean Time.
Of course. So you're there, you started a church, it has tremendous numerical success for the Northeast.
Yeah, probably 70 or 80 people came.
Yeah. Well, that's a big deal. Back. No, it grew to be hundreds of people, wasn't it? At one point, it was
700 or 800.
Well, that's I grew up in Philadelphia, and there are not churches that are 700 or 800 people in every corner, like in Nashville, where you spend part of the time, and outside of Dallas, where I live. So you had this, what people would say is a product that was very appealing to people, and clearly, what you were doing was different than what everyone else. And I would some would say, well, you just made the message of Jesus relevant to these people. And now you're probably dying inside if someone's going to describe your church that way.
Well, first of all, I didn't develop a product.
Yeah.
So right away, our language is already mismatched. I helped to catalyze a group of people that shared a common hope that we could be a community of faith that would attract or draw people to their peculiar beliefs about life and about God, and we did it, I think, by being ourselves. I mean, I just don't think we sat around going, you know, what's our strategy for getting people in the door? You know, what tinsel do we have to throw on the tree to get people to come dance around it? I mean, I think we were artists and we were musicians, and so we played music, and we didn't put a whole lot of thought into it. We just kind of did it, and people showed up to see what would happen.
No, you didn't say we were just being organic, which is how people would then say what you do. Well, we're just being organic. This is who we are. But again, I see you seem like you're not liking.
I don't know. I just find all these terms. I'm a little bit of a cynic, and so I guess I'm not a cynic. I'm a skeptic. You know.
Yeah.
Because I just always kind of lift my eyes and go, look, I don't know. It just sounds like marketing 101 classes.
Yeah.
You know, it's organic or it's, you know.
Well, here the language is.
Or it's relevant. Or
well, no, they say, are you attractional or missional? Are you organic or whatever? My brother is a salesman and he sells stuff and he always gets under my skin because he says, Luke, you're a preacher. I'm a salesman, but really we're both salesmen. You're selling a product. I'm selling a product. And we both do the same thing. And he gets under my skin every time because he's my big brother and that's what big brothers do. But it really bothers me. And I'm glad that you are just as annoyed by that sort of language as well.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, the world has been introduced to the kinds of preachers that are salesmen. And, and they make great theater on television. So they're the only ones who really get talked about in the mass media because, you know, they're just fascinating to see such strange, garish people, you know, talking about God. You know, I don't know. I would not equate sales of widgets to what a pastor does.
Yeah.
Building a church or caring for a group of people. Those are two very different animals.
What would you say is the closest comparison? If you don't want to say salesman. Obviously, you use the language of artist a whole lot. Would that be a road you'd want to go down? So that's a close comparison.
I've never been asked that question. I don't know what I would compare it to. I think it's my experience of that particular vocation is it's the hardest thing in the world to do.
Really?
Yeah, I really do.
Well, you've. Counseling? Don't you have counseling somewhere in your...
I'm a counselor, yeah.
Okay, so you've been counseling, you're a writer, songwriter, and you say... So you've done other things.
Mm-hmm.
But you think pastor is the hardest?
Oh, by far. I think anyone who's pastoring a church over 300 is in probably one of the hardest jobs there is.
Okay, tell me why.
That's not an original idea to me. I once heard Peter Drucker say he thought the three hardest jobs that he knew of were... One was a college president. The other one was the head of a hospital. And the third one was a pastor of a church of over 300.
Really? Drucker is a Harvard business guy?
I don't remember where Drucker was, where he taught, but he was the sort of icon of business.
He's a business guy, though. And so he's...
Oh, he's... Yes.
Yeah. I mean, he's...
Oh, yeah.
But he's still going to point and say, pastor...
Yeah. Well, because think about it. You're in a group of people that... is segmented into groups, all of which you think that their particular point of view is
the right one.
Is the right one, right?
Yeah.
And that their issue is the issue that has to be addressed by you as the pastor. It's highly political. You're overeducated. You're overworked. You're underpaid. You're underappreciated. And at any given moment, a significant element of the church is angry with you. You're a disappointment, people come and go, you know, they break your heart, you marry and bury their children, and they hear there's a new band on the other side of town, and they go join that church and walk out on you.
Yeah.
I mean, these are heartbreaks.
Yes. Yes.
These are painful heartbreaks. That's a hard job.
Yeah. You've brought something up that I'm not going to talk about, but yeah, you're right. It touched on something that's exactly what just happened. But, you don't strike me as someone who spent a whole lot of time watching a lot of Texas high school football.
No.
Right?
No.
Did you ever watch Friday Night Lights, the show?
I didn't watch a lot of it, but yes, I saw maybe a season of it.
A season? Did you watch the first season?
Probably.
The pilot. I don't know if the high school quarterback gets paralyzed, and he's just like the hero of Texas, and he just gets paralyzed in the field. And, I cry like a little girl during the end of that. Anyway, tangent. Texas high school football. My father-in-law is a high school football coach. Texas high school football coach. Been that for 20, 30 years. And we have this kind of running banter that being a high school coach and being a preacher, very similar. Because in both situations, the people in the stands think they can do the job of the guy in the field a lot better than he can.
Well, that's true. The other thing is, though, that the church is a theater in which people will work out and act out the deepest unattended sorrows of their lives through you.
Okay, tell me I'm at church.
Yeah.
How am I acting out? How is it the theater that I'm acting out my deepest sorrows?
You are this. Well, often it is the pastor.
No.
But if you're a person coming, let's say your marriage is a mess, your childhood is a mess, or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you bring all of your junk and the behavior that your junk evokes to your job, you're going to get fired.
Yeah.
If you bring it home to your wife, or your husband, you're going to get divorced.
Yeah.
If you try to work out your life issues in those settings, it's going to lead to some really, you know, an
avalanche
problem. If you bring it to church, though, work it out through your pastor, it's like open season. You throw $50 on the plate, and suddenly you get to go in your pastor's office and yell and scream and work out your junk. With about stuff that actually probably has nothing to do with your pastor.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember any number of times I had someone in my office and yelling at me about something I'd done or said, and I realized in the moment that I was not the only person in the room.
Hmm.
And I had to say to him, who else is in here right now?
Wow.
Because the level of vitriol that you're expressing right now is disproportionate to the crime.
Yes.
So I just need to know who else is in here right now that you're disappointed in or angry with besides me.
And what did they say?
Sometimes I have people walk out infuriated, and other people, if they were self-aware enough, would say, you're kind of like my brother who died when he was 14, and I'm still angry at him.
Really?
Or you're the, you know, you come to find out later on, you're probably the husband that, you know, or the wife that walked out and left you with the kids, or you're like the father that was always the critic. Or so in other words, you become the projection onto which other people would work their junk out
through. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, it's a very complicated task.
Okay, so for those of us here who are going through our minds thinking, when have I done that? When have I projected my junk onto being a pastor? Maybe there's other positions, maybe not so much.
We do it every day with just about everybody.
Yeah.
But we do a lot in religious settings and with religious
settings. And the environment is very conducive for that as a pastor.
That's right.
She is, or he is, paid to be nice to you. And so you feel like it is their job to be turning the other cheek and all that other stuff. So perfect, you know, target for that. What are some of the ways that those of us who might have actually done that or unbeknownst to us, have acted that out numerous times. What are some ways that we can become self-aware to know there's someone else in the room right now, and I need to deal with that junk before I can deal with whatever's right in front of me?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, one of the ways for me that I've, over the time, sort of puts a little check in my box, like, is when I know that the amount of energy that I am feeling in the moment is disproportionate to what it is I am offended or bothered by.
Okay, so this is like a...
I can feel that, okay, this is too much energy. I have a lot of energy right now. And that tells me that whatever it is that I'm angry about, that I'm talking to this person about, is loaded up with a whole lot more freight than what I realize.
Yeah.
And I need to step back and say, why is this such a big deal?
Yeah.
You know, who else is in the room? What other issue is in the room?
Yeah.
So I think it's just a matter of stepping back
and learning to name what it is that's really the issue.
Yeah, or just try and figure out what is it that, what else has, you know, what other kinds of, what do you call it, you know, when you put a an addendum on a bill, you know, when it's going through the house, you know, on the back side of a bill, you... You know, you whatever. You,
it's been a while since I watched West Wing.
Right. So anyway, if you put an addendum on a bill, you realize that what addendums have I put on this thing that are weighing it down to some, you know, in a way that's is very unhelpful to this conversation.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't have that ability. They just kind of go. A lot of people live in a trance state. Basically, they go through life on autopilot with very little self-awareness.
A trance state? Like where... just completely
right.
Oblivious and unaware to anything that's going on.
I think there are a lot of very unself-aware people, and I do think that a lot of people go through life on automatic pilot.
Okay. Tell me a common way that I am living in a trance. Just normal person. I wake up, I go to work, come home. Mm-hmm. See the kids for an hour and a half, kiss them, they go to bed, I watch TV. Is that a trance-like state? I mean, how am I?
Well, I don't know. But how many people do you know that go through life with the trance of unworthiness running in their head all the time?
So they're chanting to themselves, you're not good enough.
I mean, it's like Muzak playing in an elevator. I don't know if you remember Muzak, but it used to have this terrible music that ran on a loop in buildings, you know, like this sort of insipid kind of symphonic like takes on, you know, rock classics or something.
Yeah.
And it was awful. But it was always this background music, right?
Yeah.
I think everybody, well, not everybody, but people often go through life in this sort of a trance state where there's just loops of ideas and are running in the background of their minds and souls. And, you know, it's like, for example, the not enough loop.
I'm not good enough.
Not good enough. I'm not a good enough father. I'm not a good enough pastor. I'm not a good enough friend. I'm not a good enough this. It's just this constant. And you don't stop to hear it. It's just running.
And it's always playing there.
But you can feel it. You'll feel it in your body. You'll feel it in your heart. You'll feel it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It'll come out in ways that you don't understand. There are people who have a trance of superiority too, by the way. And it's not just narcissism. It's just people who just think they're just, you know, I'm the best.
Yeah.
The greatest, you know. And that's a different kind of a trance state. And what I mean by trance, you know, is it's like you're narcotized. You're hypnotized. You're in this kind of place where it's just this automatic pile. It just keeps looping around.
And it just comes right back up.
Nothing is interrupting the circuit to say, do you hear yourself?
Okay, what are ways to interrupt the circuit then, if we typically don't let that happen?
Yeah, well, I would say one of the ways is sort of the development of what I would call an interior witness, and that is the capacity to have another voice in your mind that's able to step back, to distance yourself from yourself, and to look at yourself and listen to yourself with a compassionate ear and say, do you hear that? Can you hear what you're saying? Can you? And then ask yourself the question, for example, is that true? And maybe you'll say, well, it feels true. And then maybe you'd say, yeah, but is it really true? Are you really a lousy father? Or were you really a lousy son? Are you you know, a failure as a pastor, as mm-hmm. a person? Are you a failure as a Christian? Is God mad at me? Is God really mad at you?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
In other words, to interrogate the uninterrogated assumptions or beliefs that are just, you know, swimming around inside your soul
yeah.
without rain. You know,
yeah.
Without anyone saying, hi, what are you doing here? You know?
Yeah.
So to develop the witness that actually can interrogate those assumptions and those trances and interrupt them and just ask the right questions and compassionately. See, I think that's what's missing so often in Christian discourse or even in Christian way that Christians speak to themselves. There's the way that people change is in compassion. It's not in the climate of judgment or condemnation. This is why legalism never works, in part, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People change when there's compassion. They don't change when there's judgment.
Why do you think compassion is what brings change?
Because
hold on. But judgment brings behavior modification, though. It gets people to do things. Like, if I'm scared that if I drink mm-hmm. anything, that I'm going to go to hell.
Mm-hmm.
There will be people who become teetotalers like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, judgment causes change. Why is behavior modification? Why do you say that compassion works better to change them?
Well, it's interesting you should say that. I think behavior modification isn't a bad phrase, but I don't think that's change.
Yeah, okay.
That's not interior freedom. I mean, I think a sign in the spiritual life that you're growing is a increasing sense of interior freedom. You're describing just a different kind of hostage-taking, spiritual hostage-taking. Mm. You know, judgment, condemnation, fear is not going to cause change. It may cause a change in behavior, but it's not going to cause a deep change at the heart level.
Yeah.
Compassion will do that. Just look at the life of Jesus.
He's typically a good one to look at.
Right? I mean, compassion. And what I mean by that is, I mean, by compassion isn't this sort of soft... Because compassion can be very hard. I mean, all you have to do is sit in a drug or alcohol intervention with a family, and you'll find out how hard compassion can be.
Yeah, yeah.
It has there's a great weight to compassion.
Hmm.
But it to me, what compassion does is it creates this beautiful climate in which the true person, the true self, can emerge without fear. If what you do is yell at me and shame me, I'll be glad to put on a religious face for you.
Yeah.
If that's what you need, and call it sanctification.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the true me is going to stay in hiding.
Okay, so let's talk about the process of how compassion gets out that false self, which we talked earlier before we were actually doing this about Merton's language of your false self. Merton, right? Did I screw it up again?
Yep,
Merton. Okay, right. Merton. Okay. How does compassion get that out? And let's get a definition of compassion before we get to that. You know, since you're about breaking the words down, the Greek word compassion isn't it literally to suffer with someone? I think it's a compound word with those two words mm-hmm. together.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the idea that compassion is that me being willing to sit with you in your pain.
Yeah, but and also to be motivated to do something about it. See, there's two other related words, which would be sympathy and empathy.
Yeah.
Right. So, to empathize with someone means to place yourself in their shoes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I empathize means, you know, I really know what it's like to be in your shoes. I empathize with you, you know?
Yeah.
To sympathize is just simply an acknowledgement that someone else is suffering, right? So if I say to you, hey, man, I'm really sorry to hear that your pet died.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's very appropriate in certain situations for me just to acknowledge your pain.
Yeah.
All I'm doing is acknowledging it and expressing solidarity in some way with you.
Yeah.
I get it. You know, empathy would be like moving just that much deeper into the experience of your suffering, you
yeah.
know, by connecting my own history perhaps with your own and
yeah.
saying I get it. But suffering with this is this intentional movement into the suffering of another to say that I'm here with you. I am suffering with you
yeah.
in this experience.
Mm-hmm.
I have a spiritual director. He's a monk in the monasteries mm-hmm. in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he's a remarkable human being. And I remember the first time I told my story to him, when we first met. And as I would talk, he would, it was a moment where he took his hand, I was sharing a particularly painful episode, and he just went like this. He put his hand across his heart and leaned into me.
Mm.
And in that moment, talk about, it was authentic. This was not a man like saying, okay, I'm now playing pastor. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to put my hand. This was just this sudden,
it felt real,
natural, you know, moving into me.
Yeah.
And I could see him visibly moved for a moment, as though he were there experiencing it with me,
mm-hmm.
and in it with me. Compassion is a very powerful thing.
Yeah.
And so for me, though, compassion is so often also just this sense that the other understands your fragility,
mm-hmm.
and what it means to be human, to be fragile, to be frail in the face of the future, and to see that, and to teach us how to cradle our fears well, you know?
Yeah.
Our fears, that our anxieties, that we spend so much of our lives defending ourselves against what's true about us, which is that we're fragile mm-hmm. creatures, contingent creatures, that we are, you know, that it's hard to be human.
Yeah.
It's very hard to be human.
Do you think that's part of what it means to bring your true self out, to deal with that fragility and how...
Well... That's a very complicated question about the true self and false self, but I would say that the true self, Merton would have said that, you know, to be a saint is to become myself. I love that idea.
Oh, say it again?
To become a saint is to become myself, is to become me. When you become fully yourself, that's when you'll know you're a saint. It's not based on your behavior. It's when your true self emerges out from behind
the nonsense of our
sort of ego, or what our ego would like to project to the world.
Yeah, it's like the training wheels that you use to get going in your life. Like, my daughter is, my oldest daughter is 5, and one of the things I try to always tell her is that, Avery, I'm proud of you. I'm proud of you. And she has repeatedly followed that statement up with the question, Daddy, why are you proud of me? Why are you proud of me? And it's almost like the false self is this thing that we use to answer that question. Like, whatever I would say as to reason why you'd be proud of me, like, that's my false self. I've achieved, I've accomplished, I've done this, I've got this degree, I've got this life, I've got this whatever. But if we're trying to move past that to get to our true self and to be this version of sainthood that you speak of, give me some ways I can get there. I don't want to always live out of this identity of, this is why you should be proud of me, because that's not my true self, right?
Well, it depends. I mean, I think, look, we're all born with original fragilities, you know, or frailties, you know.
Yeah.
Vulnerabilities, sets of vulnerabilities. And there are so many forces in our families, in our genes, in our social settings, in our, you know, political forces. I mean, so yeah. many things that shape us and make us who we are.
Yeah.
And we learn very early on about ways of relating to the world that will secure for us a sense of love, that we're loved.
Yeah.
You know, and then those get reinforced over the years by peers, by our parents, who think, wow, that's a great, gee, you know, hey, football player, you know, achiever, you know, I'm going to stroke that. And then so your kid eventually learns, well, gee, that's my whole identity. I'm the achiever.
Yeah.
And then that becomes a trance.
No,
I was just using that word again.
Yeah.
The trance is I'm the achiever. I'm the guy who makes it happen. I'm the church planner. I'm the smile, slap you on the back, shake your hand, get along with everybody guy.
Yeah.
And for me, the worst thing in the world that could possibly happen is failure. Right?
Yeah.
Nothing could be worse than failure, because my whole self is dependent on being a success.
Yeah.
Everything rides on that.
Yeah.
Well, that's just a false self. And if you're lucky, you hit about midlife and something will happen to you that'll knock that whole wall down.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes more than once.
To finally get it?
To finally, well, until you realize, well, that program just isn't going to end well.
Yeah.
And by the way, that's just one particular persona we're talking about there, one particular type of false self.
Yeah.
There are a lot of people I know have a false self of the loser. I mean, they've gone through life, you know, I'm just the loser.
Yeah. You can beat a bad trance, you can beat a good trance.
They're all not good trances. Any trance is not a good
trance.
Okay,
but more of a overtly destructive.
Sure, yeah.
And it's just, you're right.
There's the martyr. I mean, there are martyrs. There are, you know, the achiever excellers. There's the, you know, the cynic. I mean, everybody.
There's a false self that we all wrestle with.
We have a dominant one for sure, and then we probably have a lot of other ones we put on at different times.
Yeah.
But all of them have one purpose, right, which is to defend a frightened heart that is fearful that if the real self emerges, that they will be deemed unworthy of relationship.
You think that's where it all comes from?
I think that's part of it.
So the big part of our false self is...
It's a meaningful part. I don't know if it's the big part, but it's a meaningful part of it.
You're going to fight me whatever word I say. But
well, that's why I'd be careful, you know, about language. I would say that another very meaningful part of it is the spiritual dynamic, which is this: the ego runs riot. And ego, I mean, truly in the Pauline sense, right? When Paul says, I no longer live, he's using the word ego, right? And that ego to me is that false self he's talking about there. So by the way, when Paul says, you know, I no longer live, but Christ lives in me, that's really good news. It's not about the annihilation of your true self. It's about the annihilation of your false self. So when Paul says, I no longer live, he's saying, the achieving pharisaical religious person persona that I once embodied no longer lives. The real Paul is emerging.
Yeah.
See how beautiful that is?
Yeah, yeah.
He's saying when Jesus wants to kill us in baptism. What dies is the need for that false, egotistical, self-protective, fearful, manipulative, cunning, and lying persona, which attempts to try and get the world to organize its priorities around yours and to reinforce everything that you want to believe is true about you.
Yeah.
Because now even you have forgotten your true self so much that you even believe the lie that you tell others about you.
Wow.
Am I right, though?
Yeah, you're right.
You yourself begin to believe that which began at a much younger point in your life as a mask. Now you can't tell the difference between that and the real you.
Yeah, you swallow that. You've bought into that. That's who you are.
And then you find out a pastor. We can leave them nameless because there's so many of them who have this incredible thick false self, this religious false self, and then they have a big moral failure.
Yeah.
And you realize, oh man, you didn't see it, did you?
Huh.
You didn't see your dark side. You didn't see your shadow. And it was there all along.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I've seen this happen quite a bit, not just in the sort of the church world, but I've seen lots of people blow their lives up unconsciously because they were so tired of it. They couldn't continue on with this false self.
And you think they intentionally...
I think, sure, I do. I think I've seen people in my life who kind of orchestrated things to bring an end to the lie.
Okay, so you say you hit a wall. Sometimes it's midlife.
Maybe sometimes it's an illness. It could be an addiction.
Yeah.
It could be your child becoming seriously ill. I mean, you know, who knows?
These are all very
crisis will hit.
These are all crises that cause you to change.
Well, what we were talking about earlier, though, is I would say they can reveal the foolishness of the false self.
Yeah,
you know what I'm saying.
They can see that
this is a charade.
Okay, let me tell you one of my favorite proverbs. I think someone ascribed it to the Jewish tradition, but I don't know, but it's just a great one, that you have two guys that are going through a stormy forest in it's light, and one's wise and one's a foolish man. And the way you can tell them apart is when the lightning strikes. The fool looks up and stares at the lightning and goes, wow. The wise man takes a brief moment of illumination from the lightning bolt and sees the path he's on. So the wise person learns from the crisis. The fool doesn't learn. The wise person learns. Okay? So that's one way you can see the trance you're in, the false self you're living out of. I don't want to wait for that. I want to prevent the crisis that causes me to have to realize, what are ways that I can get out of that? What are ways that I can see the false self I'm living out of, the trance that I'm stuck in, that's not so dang terrible?
Mm-hmm. Well, one is, I would say, is you, I really, particularly for pastors, but for anybody, I think having a great spiritual director in your life is a critical must.
For those of us who've never really heard the language of spiritual director.
Yeah, a spiritual director is not a therapist, you know, or a psychologist per se. Spiritual director, usually in the Roman Catholic tradition, the Episcopal or Anglican tradition, Eastern Orthodox tradition, they were called doctor of souls, the carer for souls.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're interested in...
Isn't that curate? Isn't that what the word, isn't that?
Well, curate is actually newly ordained priest.
I know there's the position, but I thought the word somehow was connected to doctor of the soul. Did I just make that up?
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's the connection.
Anyway, carry on. I didn't interrupt.
But the idea of somebody who's interested less in, you know, okay, well, you know, this person has a diagnosis, this is a treatment plan, which is what a psychologist or a therapist would do.
No.
They're much more interested in saying, okay, well, what is God, what is the activity of grace in your life right now? What's grace doing in your life? And what's God up to in your life? And if you have a good one, and they're hard to find, you can find them usually in monasteries, or, you know, because there's real training involved in good,
really,
being a good spiritual director. It's not just intuition. I mean, I did spiritual direction training at the Shalem Institute and then later at Fordham University. So there's a whole literature and a whole world of learning about what it means to be a good spiritual director.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the art of asking the great questions and about holding a mirror up to your soul and saying, so, how are we?
Yeah.
That once a month. I mean, I have a spiritual director who's asked me conversations that throw me back on my heels for weeks.
Really?
Yeah, really upended my world.
Well, can you give me like one of the harder questions without being like too personal?
Sure. One of my favorites is one day I was just moaning and groaning about my life and all the terrible things that have happened to me and all the terrible things that are happening to me and all the terrible things that I'm sure will happen to me. And I was really in a very, very sort of dark, self-pitying place. And Curtis said to me, he said, very sternly, and he's a very gentle, kind soul, but he's a truth teller. So he's also not afraid. You know, he's not my pal. Spiritual director is not my friend.
Really?
No, he's not supposed to be my friend.
So Curtis is not a friend. He's just spiritual director.
He's my spiritual director.
You can't have a dual relationship.
No. Not for...
If he sees you in person...
I wish we could, but we can't.
No, if you see him in public, he's just going to ignore you and just keep on walking.
Oh, no. It's not like a psychologist. We would know each other, but we don't have an ethical thing like that. More like, you know, Curtis has to be free to say whatever he wants to me.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. You were saying what one of the questions he asked you.
So, yeah, he said to me as I was bitching and moaning and groaning, he said, Ian, this is your life, and these are the terms. So what's the invitation? What is God inviting you to do? This is it, pal. This is your marriage. This is your childhood. This is your addictive personality. This is your weird family. This is how it is.
Yeah.
You can sit here and argue about it all day long. You can moan about it. You can grieve about it. You can hit the wall about it. But this is it. These are the terms.
Yeah.
So what's the invitation?
That's a great question.
Well, that's what a good spiritual director would ask. So back to your initial inquiry, which is, you know, how do I begin to identify this false self? You get someone to ask you questions like that.
Well, it's kind of hard for a lot of us to have a person who can ask those kind of questions.
Well, I would recommend to start to look for one.
You better go find one.
Well, I think for a pastor, it's absolutely critical.
You got to have one?
Absolutely. I just think it's actually somewhat irresponsible for a pastor not to have a good counselor or spiritual director in their life.
But even just us normal people who are not pastors, we...
Why wouldn't you avail yourself of something that would be so rich?
Yeah.
And so good for you.
Okay, so you just sent us to go find some Roman Catholic monastery and find some guy.
Sounds right.
Okay, just go do that?
Yeah.
Well, that's an easy solution. Well, I think we've solved it. If you have any problems...
Find an Episcopal priest. Find someone who's a trained spiritual director in the Christian tradition.
Okay.
You usually find them among Episcopalians, Anglicans, Catholics.
Are they in the phone book?
More and more... No, I would just get a call. I don't know. Call a diocese or, you know...
That's not the same as a dialysis machine.
It's not. No, a diocese and a dialysis. Although some people would say that most some dioceses are on dialysis, but
yeah.
There's a whole world of people who do good spiritual direction.
Yeah.
And to find someone it's a great gift.
Yeah.
To have someone who can probe into your soul and speak about what they sense. And they don't tell you. A good spiritual director isn't going to tell you what to do. They're just going to ask questions that will make you realize that most of life is walking on jello, not hard ground.
Hold on, say that phrase again.
Well, that most of life is more like walking on jello than it is on hard ground. I mean, you know.
I thought the song said, isn't life like walking on broken glass?
No, I don't know that song. But okay.
Walking on broken glass? No, you don't know that song?
That's very cheerful song. but the ground underneath us is a lot less stable.
Yeah.
You know, than we'd like to think. You know, the Buddhists have that right. You know, the sense we are all afraid of groundlessness, that there's no ground beneath us. So we create structures and ideas to give us a sense that there is a ground here.
Yeah. Right?
There isn't.
No, it's not there. I heard someone tell me once that banks always have a hard floor. Like they have a tile or granite or some sort of or hardwood floor. They don't have like soft carpet. Because when you're going to go and give a lot of money to a bank to hold on to your money, you want the sense that it's a very firm foundation. Right. Right? But that's...
I think of all the time the church is wasted trying to figure out the color of the carpeting in the sanctuary.
It just needs to be hardwood floor.
It just needs to be a hardwood floor.
Or they could just do stained concrete, or they could do tile.
Actually, that's actually a great idea for a talk about the different kind of flooring that should be used in churches.
Yeah.
All the different types of streams that it could use different flooring to. It's funny.
Yeah, well, you don't have to quote me on that because I've ripped off a lot of your stuff and then quote you every time on it.
Oh, thank you. I would be be glad to.
Well, I feel like it would be quid pro quo because I tell a story like one time I was at a cookout and this really nice lady told me, love Stoops. And I pretend like that happened to me. Yeah. I'm kidding. That's from your book. That's your story. I don't take that. Yeah. All right, Ian, hey, thanks for your time. I told you we talked for like 30 minutes and we're well over that, but this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Ian.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.